This is Awani Review. My name is Cynthia Ng, and joining me on the show today is a leading environment icon from the UK, Sir Jonathan Porritt. Great to have you on the show. Sir Jonathan has done a lot in the world of sustainability. He is founder of Forum for the Future, and he is also an advisor to Sime Darby Plantation, which is where we are recording from today. Thank you for being
Pleasure.
Here.
Nice to be here.
First of all, just tell us about your role at Sime Darby Plantation. What do you do here?
Yes, it's interesting, and it's part of the work that Forum of the Future does with lots of organizations, is that we provide high-level strategic advice on sustainability issues. And that means environment stuff. Mm-hmm. It means social concerns like human rights, supply chain, and so on. We advise on economic strategy, how to make companies as efficient as possible in dealing with resources. And then governance issues. How do they deal with all the stakeholders that are interested in how different companies are performing? How do they work with their own employees? So the human capital inside a company. So you can see sustainability is a big, wide agenda. And my role here as the independent advisor to the board of Sime Darby is to help navigate all of those kind of sustainability challenges, basically.
So you're an environmentalist, and you advise a palm oil company, which criticized as a major cause of deforestation. I imagine that must put you in the crosshairs of your environmentalist colleagues quite a bit.
Yes, over the years, I have had some very lively exchanges with my colleagues in the green movement in the UK and in Europe. And that's actually one of the reasons why I do this work with Sime Darby, because I didn't know a great deal about palm oil, if I'm being honest, when I first started working with the company. This was about 8-9 years ago. And as I've got to know the sector much better and come to understand all the different issues, I am concerned about how ill-informed most Western environmentalists are about palm oil. They don't know very much about what happens on the ground. And that means that it's easy for consumers to get confused about what's happening.
What is the misinformation that you're concerned about?
The misinformation is that the industry as a whole is still involved in a huge amount of deforestation, particularly in Malaysia and Indonesia as they would see it, that it's involved in supply chain abuse in terms of workforce, migrant workers and so on, and that they are behaving irresponsibly from both a socioeconomic and environmental point of view. That's the standard view of the palm oil industry in many European countries, which is why you've got this campaign now to boycott the use of palm oil in more and more products. Now, there's no point denying that when the palm oil industry was expanding in Malaysia and Indonesia in particular, a lot of forest was destroyed. That's just the nature of the development process initially. But what I have to get my colleagues in Europe to understand is that the industry today is very different. It is part of a much more responsible way of using land to create wealth for people in increasingly sustainable ways. And it really bugs me that the environment movement in general doesn't really want to know about that. They've got a nice fixed position. It makes them feel better. And if you tell them what the real truth is, they don't necessarily thank you.
So they're not quite convinced by your arguments.
Well, it's not just me, because this is something that involves thousands and thousands of people around the world. These are huge companies that we're talking about here, supplying really valuable product to global markets all around the world. So we have to get a handle on this. We have to understand the nature of the benefits that come from an industry like this and how to work with the industry to make it more sustainable. That's the trick.
So let's talk about that, because palm oil is a necessity. It's used from everything from food to
yep.
cosmetics. Can you build the palm oil industry without killing the environment?
Yes.
Can you tell us about
Absolutely.
What makes it sustainable?
What makes it sustainable is if you've got your land bank already established, so you've got your plantations, you've got your estates already in place, and you're not converting any new land, okay, so you're not involved in any further deforestation, you're not causing the destruction of any more peat bogs or anything like that, you've got your land bank. The focus then is to ensure that you use every hectare of land available to you to provide the product that the world needs with the minimum impact on the environment and on people. Well, positive impact on people, and actually increasingly positive impact on the environment through conservation schemes mm-hmm. and all the rest of it. So there's no, there isn't something that says we'll never have a sustainable palm oil industry, because as we know, the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, which is the body created 13 years ago, whenever it was, 14 years ago, has determined the criteria to prove whether a company is performing sustainably or not. So these things can be made to work together, and it is crucial they work together, because we need the product, we need the oil mm-hmm. and all its derivatives, and we need those sustainability criteria.
So what led you down this path of sustainability in palm oil?
I like a difficult challenge is the honest answer to that. There's nothing easy about sustainability, because if you look at the whole history of human wealth creation, if you like, going back to hundreds of years to the start of the Industrial Revolution, nobody paid any attention to the environment. They abused the environment, exploited the environment, used it as a dumping ground for pollution, and the whole history of economic growth over the last X hundred years has been abused the environment, basically. So for me, sustainability has always been about how do we create wealth whilst protecting the natural world and maximizing benefits for people. That's what sustainable economic development is all about. Palm oil is right there as one of the most controversial industries to make sustainability work for. And I like that, because the world needs these industries, and we have to find ways of making them sustainable. So I also do work with airlines, for instance, mm-hmm. and that's another big, big challenge when it comes to sustainability, as you can imagine. So for me, the trick now isn't the easy stuff, it's the stuff that's difficult.
The European Union has implemented an act to ban palm oil as a biofuel by 2030. Is that good or bad? What kind of impact do you foresee from that kind of action?
It's misinformed. And the reason for that is relatively simple. If you have got product, the oil, that is certified to be sustainable, who is to say whether it should go into food, into industrial uses, into beauty care products, or into transport fuels? What's the difference in terms of the uses to which that product is being put? Now, for me, when I look at the companies that are pushing upwards towards 100% sustainability, and Sime Darby is now very, very close to 100% sustainably certified, we should allow that product to be used for the most beneficial purposes. The use of palm oil for biodiesel is more controversial than the use of palm oil for food, for industrial purposes, or for the beauty and personal care industry. And that's because in Europe there are already very big edible oil producers, sunflower, canola, or rapeseed, which are the principal sources of vegetable oils going into biodiesel. And this is quite a fierce protectionist fight, to be honest. Those big European producers, they do not like the competition with the palm oil industry, because basically the palm oil industry is more efficient than they are.
So let's put economic agenda aside and just look at the alternatives, which are rapeseed, soybean, and in terms of mitigating environmental impact in the production. How does it differ from palm oil?
Every single time you use a hectare of land for one purpose or another, you're going to have an impact on the environment. You can't avoid that.
Right.
So every time we convert forest into something else, it has an impact. But the critical criterion here is how much product can you get off 1 hectare? Because obviously you want to minimize the amount of land you need to produce the given volume of certified sustainable oil. And the huge advantage that palm oil has over all those other vegetable oils is you get much higher productivity per hectare. From a sustainability point of view, that is massive. And when I try and explain this and I say that you're going to need 5-6 hectares to get 1 hectare's worth of oil from palm oil, somehow that realization has not yet dawned in the minds of many environmentalists. So I say, okay, imagine you were completely successful in your campaign. You succeed in persuading more and more brands to stop using palm oil. They're going to have to source other oils, substitutes. What do you think happens to land use, for instance, if they choose to use soybean oil? Horrendous effects in South America as more and more land is converted to produce more soybean to produce the oil that was once provided for by palm oil. People just don't think about these things in a joined up way, in a holistic way. So the productivity, the actual amount of oil that you can get from 1 hectare is for me the key criterion of efficiency and sustainability.
However, the total oil trading volume for sustainable palm oil is still only about 20% of it, so it's
slightly
sustainable.
Less than 20%.
Why is the figure not higher? What's stopping?
Yeah, this is a really big issue, and I mean, it sometimes when I'm out here, particularly in KL or in Singapore, and talking about the industry and its performance, the fact that a lot of oil that is certified as sustainable is not actually sold as sustainable oil really is really problematic, because it means that the increased investment those companies have made in securing sustainable supply is not being turned into
product. Because consumers aren't willing to pay extra.
The big consumers are still very reluctant to pay the premium associated with sustainable oil. The hypocrisy involved in this is pretty astonishing, because these companies love to talk up their own sustainability credentials. They've made all these commitments about deforestation-free supply chains. The only way of doing that with palm oil is to pay the right price for the certified oil. That's the only way to do it. So it's taken a long time for some of these companies to come on board. I think there's been a bit of a breakthrough. I haven't checked this story, so you'll have to go with me. But Kellogg's, which has been under huge pressure for 2 or 3 years to stop using uncertified palm oil in its products, which it was continuing to do despite having signed up to deforestation-free supply chains. In the last couple of days, they've now said that they will buy certified sustainable oil. We need all of them to do that, so that the whole of the volume that is produced as sustainable can be sold as sustainable.
Well, I'll move away from palm oil for a sec and just talk about your work in general. You've worked with some of the biggest companies in the world. You've advised BP, you've advised Shell, and now you're advising Air New Zealand and Sime Darby, of course. These challenges that they face, you know, to want to become more sustainable, let's talk about that journey of yours, right? I mean, you had a, if I can put it, a fallout with BP. Quite some time back, and tell us about that. You know, why did you leave? What are you not doing?
Yes. Well, Forum for the Future is what we call a not-for-profit. It's a charity, which means that we can only do this work with companies if we can demonstrate a public benefit. So all the work we do with Sime Darby, we have to demonstrate a benefit for the sector as a whole, for society as a whole. We'd worked with BP for 10 years, and during the course of that time, we were able to get access to the board, to the chief executive, to the senior directors inside the company, to try and persuade them to reduce their dependence on fossil fuels, on oil and gas, and ramp up their investments in renewable energy, which was going to cause less of a problem from a climate perspective. We thought we'd made good progress, but to be honest, when we came to assess the degree to which the company was really moving its investment base, we came to the conclusion that they were playing fast and loose mm-hmm. with environmental claims, what is called greenwash. And both Shell and BP, I'm sorry to say, were some of the guiltiest parties when it came to greenwashing. They basically weren't changing anything, and they were carrying on doing the same old stuff they'd always done. So it was impossible for us any longer to work with those companies because there was clearly no public benefit from the engagement we were having. And that was quite a harsh lesson for all of us, because one likes to think that not just us, but the advice coming from lots of other organizations is gradually changing these companies. And when it doesn't, it's disappointing.
Do you feel more encouraged now, 10 years on? You see companies like, for instance, Repsol committing to a zero emission in 20, 30 years.
Yep.
And Shell has came up to say, okay, we're going to halve yep. our emissions. What do you feel?
Yeah, and BP has just announced a new net zero position mm. by 2050. Look, I'm glad that they are all getting in the game. But the scale of the transformation we need is so much bigger than these companies seem to understand. So when people talk about, this is jargon, okay, but we have to unpack this jargon. When people talk about net zero emissions by 2050, it means that we pretty much have to stop burning fossil fuels for electricity, for transport purposes, and in many industrial uses. We pretty much have to get out of fossil fuels altogether in order to get to net zero by 2050.
You think that's impossible?
No, I don't think it's impossible, but they think it's impossible because they don't think the technology is there to provide all those solutions. That is no longer true. Mm-hmm. If you look at what is happening with renewable energy, particularly with solar and wind, these technologies are now able to compete on a like-for-like basis with coal, oil, gas, and nuclear. So we can make these transitions.
So let's talk about that, right? The transition, the
yeah.
motivation to move into renewables. Just look at what's the oil price today. It's hovering about 55. It was above 60 just a month ago. The trend is moving towards, that's the new normal. Lower oil price discourages companies to move into renewables.
It depends. The truth is that the price of oil is extremely volatile mm-hmm. and the investments that have been made historically in renewables have, you are right, always been made when oil prices are very high, because then the attraction of renewables is much stronger. We're out of that stage now
okay.
because the cost of renewables has come plummeting down so fast that these technologies can now compete with oil at the current prices, anything down to anything, $50 a barrel, whatever it might be, renewables will still continue to outcompete with fossil fuels. And these price points continue to get better every year. So there's a 6% reduction in costs of solar every year. There's a 5% reduction in wind power technology every year. There's something like a 4 to 5% reduction in battery costs, storage being a crucial part of the renewables element. Those costs keep coming down year on year. We're not anything like at the end of this technology revolution for solar, wind, renewables, storage, smart grids, everything. People just need to wake up to the fact that the age of fossil fuels is now coming to an end, and the age of renewables, the solar age in particular, is starting right now.
I want to get your thoughts on working with leaders. Mm. You know, you've worn so many hats throughout your career, politician, author, and advisors to governments and now corporates. What kind of leader do you choose? When you look at the leader, what kind of characteristics do you look at when choosing to work with them? If they tell you, I want to make my company more sustainable.
Well, that's an interesting question, because you are right, it is all about leadership. And that is down to personal commitment and personal values. It's very hard to be a CEO of a company or a leading politician doing sustainability well if you don't really believe in it, if you haven't really got it sorted out in terms of your own commitment, your own values. So you look for personal integrity as well as for corporate ambition, and these two things have to come together. The third element then is the ability to lead your organization, to bring your organization with you, and to make people excited about it. The one thing that really bugs me, for me, the sustainability transition is the most exciting thing going on in the world today. Okay, it's brilliant. It is all about new ways of creating wealth, more fair economies, better technology, better outcomes for the planet and future generations. It is as upbeat an agenda as you can possibly imagine. I find a lot of politicians and a lot of corporate leaders kind of really grumpy, as if they were being forced to do this when they didn't really want to. Mm-hmm. And for me, that doesn't add up. You've got to want this to work. You've got to put your heart and soul into it. So when I'm thinking about leaders, it's people who buzz with this kind of real passion for making it possible for people to live well on this planet without destroying prospects for future generations.
Do you feel more encouraged now than when you first started? Given it's the issue of sustainability is getting more recognition and people are talking about it, but action and progress is still somewhat quite slow.
Yes. I've been doing this for 45 years. So it's been a long journey, to be honest. And I can't help but reflect on how ridiculously slow the change has been. I am more encouraged now. I'm more hopeful today because awareness is rising all the time. The science behind all of this, behind climate change, behind biodiversity, all of these kind of things, the science is so strong now that it's very hard for people in business or politics to just brush it aside. The thing that makes me most hopeful, however, is young people, because there is a new source of energy now. We've seen this all around the world in the last 18 months. School strikes, young people saying, this is not acceptable. You're creating wealth for yourselves today, but only at the expense of us and future generations. So I'm looking to that new energy from young people as the change factor in the whole story now. And when I reflect on the fact that by the end of this year, there will be 2 billion people on planet Earth under the age of 20, all much more connected than people have ever been before, and much more focused on the priority of protecting the environment. Politicians had better wake up, because the voters of the future are not going to be like voters today. They're going to be demanding a completely different quality of leadership around this. That's what makes me hopeful today.
Thank you so much, Jonathan, for your insights. It's been lovely to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.